I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
And John, I don't know about you where you live in New Jersey, but where I live in Colorado, it is now full on snow season. We are getting more snow every day. It's annoying me because I have to shovel snow. And then once I shovel snow, the snow happens again. And it's just this vicious, vicious cycle.
We haven't been getting a lot of snow yet, a little bit, but I know this morning it was like 12 degrees. I went for a walk with my son and it was like 12 degrees out. So it's been cold. It's been cold for sure.
Yeah. See, and today we're actually getting the 40, 45 degree weather.
Yeah, that's how it works.
So it's like snow, 45. Welcome to Denver.
Yeah. Well, someone that lives on the East Coast as well is our guest today, and her name is Sarah Kozloff. She is a fantasy author, and she's got a new epic fantasy series coming out. The first book in the series is called A Queen in Hiding. So for all you listeners out there who complain about, I don't want to start a new series because, you know, it'll take forever for it to come out and it'll take years and who knows if they'll write the next book. Here's a little bit of trivia about Sarah's books that are coming out. The first book, A Queen in Hiding, out January 2020. Next book, February 2020. Next book, March 2020. Next book, April 2020. She has four books coming out in 4 months, which is, I've never heard of such a thing before. But Sarah, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Now, I think, well, first of all, why don't you tell us a little bit before we get into the four books in 4 months thing, why don't you let our listeners know a little bit, little snapshot, little taste of what they can expect if they get into reading your new epic fantasy series, The Nine Realms.
Well, it's pretty classical epic fantasy in that it takes place in a pre-modern era. I like horses, so, you know, people travel around on horses. This is not urban fantasy or anything like that. It's very focused on relationships between the characters, mothers and daughters and families, and it's very epic in scope. Many different realms, many different families, many different people with different aims. I've heard from a few readers that they need to use the appendix, which is at the back of the book, not the front of the book. So you can find it there if you ever get confused as to who's who. But I did my best to make patterns in the names that told you what nationality or whatever the characters were, so that it's very sweeping and large and many points of view.
Awesome. Now, you mentioned the horses, and I have to bring this up. Do you ride horses yourself?
I have ridden. I'm not an accomplished rider, but I grew up in the West. I grew up in Denver, Patrick, and woohoo! And I grew up, you know, when it was still had its Western heritage. I was first on a horse when I was 5. I like horses. I like the idea of a story taking place where you travel on horseback. Maybe it's all the Westerns I've seen and taught in my life.
That's awesome. I bring it up because people who are generally fans of fantasy literature, there is a community of horse riding enthusiasts, and they will call you if they feel like you have not portrayed horses accurately. Patrick, I know you and I both experienced this with various listeners and guests.
Oh yes. I remember someone on Facebook commented that the trailer for the new Disney Mulan live action was terrible because they had the wrong horses for that time period in China.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Yes, I know. I was, first, I know a little bit, but second, I did check with some of these horse experts, you know, about, you know, I was not going to mix a gelding and a stallion, I know that much, and I was not going to have my mares in heat and things like that, but I wasn't quite sure about foraging in winter forests and things like that, so I did check with some experts on Twitter who said, before you write your fantasy novel, make sure you have all your horse details proper.
They are right, because you will. people will call you on it. I don't know how many, but there is a passionate horse following that will nail you on that. But I'm glad to hear you did that research. So it was very good. And why don't you tell us a little bit about this idea of the books coming out so quickly. Were the books already written for the most part before Tor picked them up?
Yes. Well, so this is not my doing. This is a function of my ignorance. I had never done any creative writing before. I had never been involved in the literature community. I thought that series were all written before. So I wrote all four books before I approached an agent. And then the agent was very intrigued that they were finished. And then Tor was very intrigued that they were finished. And my editor, Jen Gunnels, said, well, let's go to this rapid publication schedule. So that was really her idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea, because that I know people who are listeners of the show who are just, people in our community in general, who won't start series that are not finished. Because unfortunately, there is obviously the most famous example is probably George R. R. Martin and people waiting around for the final books. And there's many other examples too. And people, I guess, don't want to be burned by getting very invested in a series and then not having it completed. So I think it's an interesting approach to take, for sure.
Also, I don't know about you, but my memory fades of a book if it's more than 18 months before, the next one comes out. And I have to refresh myself. Now, who were those characters? What was happening, right? So,
Which spurs the reread.
Yes.
You always reread the book before the next one comes out.
But now let me put you on the spot. Do you reread all of them for the third one?
Well, I don't know if I'm typical or if I'm just an outlier functional nerd, but yes, I reread them all. Like I used to do, and John and I have talked about this before, one of my favorite series was The Wheel of Time. Mm-hmm. And I used to sit down when a new book would come out, I would reread from the beginning and I would go through all the books and then I would read the latest one.
Yeah.
That is commitment.
I think I'm an outlier. Yeah. So yeah. It's interesting that you thought that you had to have them all written and the whole series done. A lot of times it depends on the publisher and the editor and even the agent as to whether or not they want that.
Right. Right.
There are some who don't want that because they want to have some sort of input or feedback into the development of the series and the directions that it takes.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't even so serious about publishing when I started. I mean, I had a job. I've had a career. I was doing this more as a lark than strategically building a new career as a novelist. I was just writing my fantasy. And then, I had four and it was finished. And then I started, trying to figure out what to do with the books. So I'm not sure I would recommend this to other authors, but this worked for me. And it worked for me in a lot of interesting ways in that book. When I got to book four, I realized there were little seeds and foreshadowing I wanted to put back into book one. When I decided that all the names from a certain realm should have a similar sound, I could go back to book one and two and three and change all the names. I could go back to the map as I wrote so that the map really worked before it had ever been published.
Sure.
There were all sorts of ways in which I could tie the four books together because they all had been written.
And I think you speaking to, and we should mention to our listeners, I think it'd be kind of an interesting thing for them to know if they're not aware that Sarah is speaking of her of her career prior, and you know, in addition to being a novelist now, is that she worked in filmmaking and is a professor of filmmaking at Vassar.
Actually, not filmmaking. I was a professor of film history.
Film history. Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about that, because obviously there are certainly parallels, and I'm sure, you know, just storytelling in general, a lot of the lessons learned in studying film would carry over to writing a novel, I would suspect. Maybe you could tell our listeners a little something about that.
Yeah. So I have been blessed to have a sort of dream career where I taught really lovely students the movies I love the most. I did teach some survey courses on world cinema, but then I specialized on American genre films, and I would teach musicals or westerns or romantic comedies or war films or Hitchcock, and I would lead the students through the way American history affected the films, American culture, how it was figuring in the movies, and, you know, gender roles and ideology. And that was wonderful. But one day I was in a class on American women directors, and we were looking at a list of films that could not pass the Bechdel test, which is a very low bar of how feminist a film is, whether it has two women characters who talk to each other in it. And The Lord of the Rings could not pass the Bechdel test, because although it has Galadriel and Eowyn and Arwen, they are in separate storylines, and they never talk to one another. And at that moment, I said, I will write an epic fantasy in which women talk to each other. And I just decided that was something I wanted to try. So, I think my film background affected the series. While one review, I think it was Kirkus, said I have a pronounced instinct for pacing. And I think that comes from all the movies I've seen.
Well, yeah. And when we get to like kind of the main discussion after our picks of the week, I do want to talk about an article that you'd sent me that you'd written talking about, particularly about voice and showing and don't telling. And we'll get into that. But you could tell there's a lot of experience in analyzing movies and analyzing pacing and all of those kinds of things that I think are going to have an impact on your storytelling. So love to get into that. So before we get into that main part, let's first, I would like to thank our listeners, and thanks for the people who back us financially every month over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. We really appreciate it. It helps us do the show every week. So thank you for those folks that back us. For people who are listening who don't back us, consider becoming one of our backers if you enjoy these conversations with folks like Sarah. It's patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can back us for $1 a month, a couple bucks a month, whatever works for you. It really helps, and you get access to our patron-only Facebook group where we talk about lots of fun genre things, and we're now getting into the beginnings of possibly doing some sorts of creative collaboration with our the people who are over there, including Patrick and myself. So thank you once again, and now we're going to get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And speaking of our patrons, I'm going to read one of our patrons' pick of the week. And this is Paul Jackson. And he said, not sure if I'm too late, but I have really enjoyed Lock and Key on Netflix this week. Only started it a couple of days ago, but already on episode 8. Good story, world building, and FX, creepy vibe, and well acted. I've never read any of the comic books, but I don't feel I've missed out by not. Although, like The Witcher, you might get more from the series if you know the source material, but it did not feel diminished. It didn't diminish my enjoyment of it. So Lock and Key, Patrick, we didn't talk about it. I didn't watch that yet, but that is certainly...
I haven't watched it either.
Yeah. I know you read the comics of that, though, correct?
I did, yeah.
Okay, cool. So that's something that I'm sure will come up later. But that is Paul Jackson's pick, Lock and Key, on Netflix. Sarah, what is your pick this week?
My pick is on Amazon Prime. It's the series, I do not like the title. It's called For All Mankind. It stars Joel Kinnaman. Have you been watching it?
It's about NASA. Is that correct? Or
yes, okay. It's an alternate history space race.
Oh.
And I'm actually, you know, more invested in fantasy than I am in sci-fi. But my husband and I started watching it, and the first two episodes, I was not that invested. And episode three just sort of electrified me. So I would urge your listeners to give it a chance, through three or four episodes and see if they don't find it very interesting.
Yeah, that's often the way with a lot of these series. You really have to give it a little time to percolate and see. And if you get three or four episodes and it's not working for you, then, you know, that's maybe it's just not for you then, but I find right. often you can't just do the first episode. Like sometimes it does, but for the most part, you got to give it three or four. So cool.
Absolutely.
That's great. Patrick, what's your pick this week?
I'm going with a brand new album.
Oh, okay.
It's called Weather, and it's from Huey Lewis and the News.
Oh, nice.
It's their very first album, I believe, in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Brand new album. And
I was going to say, I'm not sure. Didn't know they were still recording.
Yeah. Well, and kind of as part of this came out why they haven't done much recording. Apparently Huey Lewis suffers from an inner ear condition that messes with his hearing a lot. And as an example, they worked through the album and recording, and just as they finished mixing it, he completely lost all his hearing.
Hmm.
And it has come back in a little, but he's still struggling. Like, it comes and goes, and it's something that he's lived with for many, many, many years. So if you search Huey Lewis in the News and new album, you'll find articles that talk about his hearing loss and the things that he's had to do. But it's a great album. It is definitely a Huey Lewis in the News album. Like, it sounds like what was it called? Was it Sports? What was the name of the album?
That was the big one. Sports was the one that had a lot of the hits on it. Yeah,
I mean, it feels like they never stopped. Like, they never took a break.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm enjoying the songs on it. You can listen to the whole thing on Spotify. It's out there. I know that I posted this on Facebook, and a couple of our patrons like went out and immediately bought the album. And we're listening to it. It's a great album. And I don't think it's just nostalgia. It's what we always talk about, John. Good music is good music. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is a good album with good music on it.
Cool. I will check it out. I didn't know that about him. I was wondering why I hadn't seen him around playing as much, because I know they were still playing like long past their like sort of hit era. They would still be out hitting the theaters and all that. So. Cool. My pick this week is a book, and I think this will be of particular interest to our listeners, and I would hope to Patrick and Sarah as well. It is, the author's name is Marianne Wolfe, and she is a kind of a specialist. She has degrees in neurology, but she sort of specializes on the reading brain. This book is called Reader, Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. So it's all about how our brains, developed as we were reading. And now with all of our devices and everything, how she's concerned about our ability to stay focused on reading an actual book rather than just reading things online or social media or emails. And she gets pretty deep into it. And it's very interesting because this is something that I think I bring this up quite frequently about how I try to take breaks from my devices and how I try to focus on just reading actual novels and long form books rather than just skimming things online. And it's a really fascinating book, and she gets into it and how it's not all doom and gloom, but how she is concerned that as adults, how some of us are losing the ability to read long books or just books in general. I think, unfortunately, if you survey just some people in your life and you say, oh, when's the last time you read a book? You may be terribly disappointed that they may say like, oh, I haven't actually read a book in years. And you know, I think the people we hang with, I'm imagining I would include Sarah on this. We're probably hang out with people who read more than your average citizen, but I think it is unfortunately probably in the decline. And she's worried that in losing that ability, it could be of detriment to society in general about how we're going to start, you know, just not being good citizens because of it, because we're sort of not, you know, one of the point, not to get too deep into the book, but basically about how through reading, it helps us with so many skills of being a human being, just to get in somebody else's brain and see somebody else's point of view, the other person, not just to be so sort of self-focused. How if we're not reading as much, we're going to start losing that ability. And she's particularly worried about our children and how they're exposed to these devices, and how if we don't get them to read and encourage them to read, that maybe they're not going to develop those skills of empathy and everything else as much as they could, and how that may be of detriment to our society. So it's very good. I really enjoyed it. Once again, it's called Reader Come Home, the Reading Brain in a Digital World. And the author is Marianne Wolfe, who wrote another book called Proust and the Squid, which is just about reading in general, not so much about digital books, but I haven't read that one yet, but I'm going to read that now because I really enjoyed this new one. So there you go. Sarah, I feel like you had some thoughts about that.
I'm gonna look it up. Yeah. It sounds really fascinating because I've often wondered how different media affect human beings, affect our perception of the world. I have a theory that movies taught us how to read people's facial expressions. Mm-hmm. That before there was photography in movies, we didn't know as well as we do now. You know, when you go and you see those big close-ups in the movies, right? You know, oh, she's sad. Oh, he's just realized that, you know, that guy is the bad guy, right? You learn to read into expressions because you're studying people's faces. Were people able to do that before photography in movies?
That's a fascinating point that I've never thought about before, but I think you might be onto something there, because you're right. When and you talk about this in that article that I alluded to mm-hmm. earlier in the show about how with art, a lot of this talk about showing versus telling, and the what your point of view to sort of simplify it is just basically like, telling's not as bad as we always kind of say. It's like, you know, like, yes. And we can get deeper into that. But one of the things you point out is that really with movies, you know, you're saying like about facial expressions and, you know, music will be there to sort of cue you how you're supposed to be feeling now. And there might be certain right. lighting, or there might be certain things. So it's all of these other things. Instead of saying it, it's showing the facial expression, hearing the music, seeing the background. So aren't we being just as obvious about it as if we just came out and said it anyway with all of these other things? So that's very interesting.
Right. That showing is just another form of telling, a more covert form of telling. Because, you know, basically narrative is conveying a tale from a teller to a listener. And the ways in which you do it are varied, and some are good for some purposes and some are good for others. I wouldn't throw any of them out, you know, baby with the dishwater. I've, in my academic life, I've been a defender of dialogue and voiceover. I think it's crazy when people talk about film and just talk about the cinematography or the editing, because I care about the people. And it's usually, here we are on a podcast, it's usually the voices and what they're saying that gets you deep into the people's personalities.
I would love if you would share your thoughts. In that article, you talk about Blade Runner. And I would mm-hmm. love if you can give us a little bit of your opinion about Blade Runner and the voiceover versus the version without the voiceover in that movie.
I think I say in that article, I'm the only person I know who likes the studio voiceover version better. The studio voiceover version is imitating film noir and has, you know, Harrison Ford as the sort of hard-boiled detective figure. And I think, first of all, that that's such an apt and brilliant genre mixing, and that it makes him a figure that we can empathize with more than when we lose his voice. Also, in general, I'm not a person who believes that studios were always wrong and that director's cuts are always the unvarnished, you know, great work of art. I'm glad that the first Apocalypse Now is only as long as it is. And I didn't want to sit through Apocalypse Now Redux, where the director is able to add in the deleted scenes and make it another hour long. Studios exerted their power in ways that sometimes were for the audience's advantage, not just to thwart the director's vision or auteurist skill.
I think it's interesting that you bring that up, because whether it's filmmaking or writing a novel, they are collaborative processes. Obviously, with mm-hmm. writing, every writer we've ever spoken to on the show almost always has high praise for their editor. Mm-hmm. And that is part of the process. And I know Patrick brings this up sometimes with, we'll use fantasy as an example, because many successful fantasy books tend to be long, you know, 1,000 right. plus pages quite often. And I know Patrick brings up this point, is that as you have some authors that have been around for a while, how maybe the editorial hand is much looser because the editor is mm-hmm. probably someone that's a younger person. And mm-hmm. I think, Patrick, you brought up Stephen King before about how he, maybe you could tell a little bit about that story you told about Stephen King and about how what he spoke to his editor about.
Well, it's a famous story. It got covered quite a bit. Basically, he was turning in books and they were like, he would turn in a book and they'd say, okay, we're going to publish it on this date. And he said, what about the editing? Oh, well, you're Stephen King. You don't need editing. And he threw a massive fit and said, I absolutely effing need editing. You have to edit me. But he had to throw a fit in order to get editing on his books, because they just got to a point where they're like, well, gosh, you're Stephen King. You know, we can't edit you.
Huh.
Yeah, so he's covered. Sorry.
Yeah, but he's right. Of course he's right. Because, you know, as a writer, you're only in your own head. You need feedback. You need experience. I needed my editor, Jen Gunnels, at Tor. And she was very instrumental in many ways, especially because you don't know how other people are reading what you've written. Of course you need to be edited. You need to be edited, like, severely. Maybe I should have been edited more. Of course, everyone needs to be edited.
Absolutely.
And yeah, so we talk about it in fantasy sometimes, is that you have some successful authors, and oftentimes what a criticism of some of those books are is like, probably could have been cut down a little bit. Maybe it didn't need to be 1,200 pages. Maybe it would have been better at like 800 pages. You know, we didn't need to be in the forest that long, or whatever the case may be. Right.
Well, and John, I'll even throw it out. It's not just fantasy. Like Tom Clancy, if you look at the Clancy books, the Jack Ryan books, they start out pretty trim.
Yeah.
And as time goes on, they get thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker. And I forget which one it is. I forget at this point. It may have been Clear and Present Danger. It may have been The Sum of All Fears. There is an accident that happens because cars are in the fog, and like a 16-year-old teenager just got her first car, and she's driving like crazy through the fog, and she doesn't see the truck in front of her, and you know, basically there's this huge accident that happens. But there are, I want to say, a really long chapter, maybe two, before that event happens, that is the manufacturing of the car.
What?
And the car's trip across the ocean on a big shipping boat. And you know, there's a flaw in the manufacturing process and the gas tank, and then the trip across the ocean, the salt water and the air corrodes the gas tank, and the flaw, until it finally gets to the dealership where it's bought by the parents, who then give it to the daughter as the present. And like, there's this whole big, long, drawn out thing that didn't need to be there.
Yeah.
And my whole, like, where was the editor?
Right.
Well, yeah, I think that kind of speaks to probably success and editors probably being younger sometimes than the creators. So that happens.
Or even with Tolkien, I can't get people to read The Lord of the Rings because they get bogged down with Tom Bombadil and the Barrow Downs, which are in the first part of book one and don't have anything to do with the main story. And, you know, I wish Tolkien's editor had cut that.
And
because.
Yeah. And that's what they did in the movies. They cut that out of the movie. Yes.
And then it was a huge uproar. Oh my God, where's Tom Bombadil? You can't have a movie without Tom Bombadil.
Yes, you can.
And it was better because they didn't have Tom Bombadil.
Peter Jackson did a good job without Tom Bombadil.
Exactly. You know, getting back to the sort of voiceover thing, it's funny, as I read your article, Sarah, how many movies that I really enjoy have that. And you brought up a bunch of them. And a lot of them, we can sort of describe as romantic comedies. And I saw many of these movies when they came out because I feel like my mm-hmm. wife and I went to go. So we were probably in our 20s when these movies. We're in our 40s now. We were in our 20s when a lot mm-hmm. of these movies came out, and I love them. So you mentioned High Fidelity, About mm-hmm. a Boy, 500 Days of Summer, mm-hmm. and Bridget Jones's mm-hmm. Diary, which is my wife's all-time favorite movie. She's probably watched that movie 50 times at home. And the voiceover really works in all. And I, you know what? Look, I at the time, if you asked me if there was a voiceover in any of those movies, I would have been like, I don't know. I don't like. I totally forgot that there even was a voiceover in those movies. So it's not something that took you out of the movie. If anything, it enhanced and was good storytelling device, I felt.
Yeah. And I mean, I love voiceover. I love the sound of someone's voice talking intimately to you in the movie theater. I feel personally addressed.
Right.
It makes me, it really draws me in. And it's used in many genres. Film noir, it's often used in adaptations. But sort of the surprise, like you've noticed, is how often it's used in other genres too. In romantic comedy, sometimes it's used in musicals. You just never know. And every time, oh, there's a voice. And it's great. I mean, I've never forgotten this is not voiceover, but it is direct address. Clive Owen talking straight to the screen in that Spike Lee heist movie. Do you know what I'm talking about? I've forgotten the title right now, but it's he's like, listen up, I'm only going to say this once, and you just sort of bolt right up in your seat and wake up. He's addressing you. You've got to pay attention.
Yes, that's Inside Man. I did a little Google sleuthing for us. Inside Man, yes, from 2006. So,
yes.
Cool. Yeah. You know, another movie I would throw in there, because it was a little bit later. I think it was 2013, and I only recently watched this. It was up on Netflix. I don't know if it's still there, but it's a movie called About Time, and it fits in a little bit with those kind of romantic comedies that you mentioned.
Yeah, it's another Richard Curtis romantic comedy.
Yes, but a little obviously there's time travel in it, and mm-hmm. so it's a little bit of a mashup, although they don't get too bogged down by the mm-hmm. time travel. But mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure there's a voiceover in that now that I'm thinking about it, and it was very effective because it kind of helped kind of explain a little bit of the time travel aspect and sort of the character's emotional journey. And I found that to be helpful and felt very close to those characters. And I think that voiceover was a big reason why.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, some of my scholarship, there was a big movement against voiceover, not only in fiction films, but in documentary. It was thought to be voice of God and undemocratic. And I'm saying, well, maybe it's less democratic to hide what you're thinking and try and get the viewer to figure it out from the editing. Maybe then you're kind of fooling the viewer and making him think you're objective when really your editing is as controlling as any voice could be.
Yeah. And I thought you had a lot of really interesting opinions, and yeah, it's, you know, you talk about what you just said in terms of ethics, and a quote from your article is hiding one's opinion is less ethical than stating it directly. And I think you're right there. I think that's something that we don't think about too often, but I think that's a pretty accurate statement, something to think about.
Hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the other things I've talked that you mentioned in the article, which I think is interesting, and you were talking about the studios, you know, not always being wrong. You know, I think there's this like very romantic notion that the studios are keeping the creators down and, you know, we want to support their artistic vision and all that, but you're like, yeah, you know, in the end, you know, studios aren't always wrong and they often have, the, but you know, one of the,
I seem to remember the David Lynch Dune movie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Did not test well with audiences. They were very confused.
Mm-hmm.
And the studio added the Virginia Madsen voiceover and intro to that movie to kind of explain. And that tested better with audiences.
Well, sure. Especially when you're creating a very complicated world that takes hundreds of pages to explain on a screen, right? I mean, on a page, you're just going to throw people into the screen without any orientation. And Star Wars starts with a crawl, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not with a voice, but with a text. And we need that to figure out what's happening in a galaxy far, far away.
Yep.
You know, I think a great quote to for any creative person from your article is talking about being confused. You're like, is ambiguity always and in every instance a virtue? I think oftentimes we do kind of consider that, we'll leave a mystery, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it is better to, oftentimes it's better to be very direct.
Yeah.
I would think. And, you know, you know, you were talking about Clive Owen and, you know, talking to the screen, so something more maybe genre specific. I don't know if you've seen them or are familiar, but that's kind of the Deadpool movies. He breaks the fourth wall, and that's directly from the source material, from the comic book. So he would mm-hmm. always do that. He would always mm-hmm. do that. So what's your opinion of that kind of thing? Now, obviously, that's kind of very superhero-y and kind of crude and all of that. But what's your take on that, if you have one?
I haven't seen the Deadpool stuff. I'm not, you know, I'm not a person who's versed in comic or superheroes. But I like it when people break the fourth wall. I mean, some of the things I liked. Do you remember Winnie the Pooh? Winnie the Pooh cartoons used to break the fourth wall. And I always found it funny. Engaging that the text would acknowledge the relationship between the viewer and itself. You know, you're there. I see you. Hi.
Well, but you could go back further and potentially see like what I would consider classic films. I don't know if Deadpool's a classic yet, but if you went back to, you could go back to say Blazing Saddles.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of scenes where, you know, the sheriff kind of looks at the screen, like looking at the audience going, mm-hmm. really, really? And Gene Wilder does the same thing.
Yeah.
Like there's a couple of shots where Gene Wilder just looks at you and he's like, okay.
Well, you...
he doesn't necessarily say anything to you, but he's looking at you and he's like, okay.
Well, you guys are probably too young, but did you ever see Cat Ballou?
Oh, yes. I loved Cat Ballou. Cat Ballou is a fantastic freaking movie.
Cat Ballou is great. And it's got... the two troubadours who are narrating and looking at the camera and commenting on the action. That's right.
Yep. Just, and was it one of them? Oh my goodness.
I want to say Nat King Cole, but I made
Nat King Cole. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. So it was kind of maybe progressive for the early 60s. It was fun.
It was.
You know what I want to bring up as we're probably running down on time. I'm going to bring up a book that I'm currently reading, which is a recent tour book as well by Jen Lyons. I don't know if you know Jen Lyons personally at all, Sarah, but I'm very much enjoying book one of her A Chorus of Dragons book. It's called The Ruin of Kings. And talking about, she has a version of this. I don't know if you read the book, Sarah, but... I've never seen this before. I'm sure it's probably not the first time a fantasy author has done this. So it's a lot of world building, but she's, you know, really character focused and everything. There are footnotes.
Now, yes.
I'm reading the book on a Kindle. So I just like tap it and then it takes you to the footnotes.
Right.
The footnotes are written kind of breaking the fourth wall. Not so much, but just from a point of view is like, she's talking about this world as if it's the real world. And so like a character will say something and she, you know, essentially it better language than what I'm going to say. It's like, well, we're not so sure about that. I mean, that, you know, really history says that this, and I find it like the most appealing. It's why I was kind of hooked in on this after the third or fourth of those notes that I realized that was going to be a thing every few pages that she was going to throw in. It's great because it's sort of gives you a step outside of the story a little bit, and then it helps you to kind of go back in. So I thought it was very clever and very well done. And obviously a ton of world building on her part to be able to do that. So it's a great device. And I think it's really wonderful. So that kind of thing can work.
I think you'd like 10,000 Doors of January, which interweaves chapters. The first one is written as if it was just a normal, you know, fantasy chapter. And then the second one is by a chronicler who's trying to find out where, you know, who's studying the events that have happened in the first chapter. And then you keep reading and then the chronicler's life interweaves with the action. But it's, you know, playing with narrative form in a novel and entertaining and engaging way.
Cool. I will definitely check that one out then. Awesome. Well, we are about out of time. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on the show. Once again, to let people know about Sarah's books, the first one is already out. It's A Queen in Hiding. The second one, The Queen of Raiders, due out in February. So what's the public? Is it out already, Sarah? What's the date?
It's coming out on Tuesday the 18th.
Perfect, because that's the day this episode airs. So people, when you're done listening to this episode, go and buy A Queen in Hiding and then The Queen of Raiders. They will both be out. and then if you like them...
You had timed this for that. You didn't?
You know what? It is shocking how much that happens without timing it on purpose, but that happens quite a bit because our episodes go out on Tuesday and I guess that's sort of release date for books quite a bit. So we do tend to hit that more than we plan on, but I'm always delighted when it happens. I don't know why I always get such a thrill out of that. But anyway, so those first two books will be out and then A Broken Queen and the book for the Cerulean Queen will be out in March and April. So go and check that out. Sarah, where can people find you online? Do you have any con appearances coming up or signings or things like that people can check you out at?
Oh, I'd love to see them. I am actually talking to you from book tour right now. I'm in Washington. I spoke last night at a bookstore. I'm traveling most of March and April, first to the Midwest and then all around the West Coast. Then I'll be at a conference in Orlando. People can see my schedule at sarahkosloff.com.
Awesome. And well, that's great.
And they can get the book everywhere. Independent booksellers are selling it. Obviously, Amazon. The audiobook is already out. The audiobook for Queen of Raiders will come out on Tuesday.
Fantastic. Awesome. Yeah. Many of our listeners are big audiobook people. So I always like to hear
of
that.
Of course, podcasters yes. would be audiobook. And I also, since I love voiceover, I've written on audiobooks. I love audiobooks myself.
Awesome.
I love audiobooks. I read, I don't know how many last year, John, but almost every book I read was an audiobook.
Yeah. No, that's great. Well, awesome. Well, thank you, Sarah. Once again for us, thanks everybody for listening. Particular thanks to our patrons. If you would like to become one of our backers, go to patreon.com/functionalnerds. Patrick, what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
That's it. I'm good.
All right, everybody. Have a good week, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Functional Nerds podcast. If you like what we do, consider supporting us by visiting patreon.com/functionalnerds, telling two of your friends about us, or providing a review on your favorite podcatcher. This podcast is copyrighted by the Functional Nerds Podcast, which is Patrick Hester and John Anilio, under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Theme music created by and used with permission of John Anilio. To learn more about the Functional Nerds, visit functionalnerds.com.